Okay, we are at 7:30 mark, so I'm gonna go ahead and get started. So we, as usual, I'll start off by muting all, and everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so with comment or question, or use the chat window and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And if you, if we have any guests with us tonight, welcome. We always welcome guests at the Ottawa PC User Group meetings. If you want to join, I paste it into the chat where you can go to join, or if you just go to our home page on the website, you'll see a join or renew link at the top. Go through there, and you can join either by mailing us a check for $20, or there's a PayPal option, or you can do an interact funds transfer. So lots of ways you can join our happy little band. We'd be happy to have you join us. Okay, something a little bit different. I'm going to be sharing tonight, so if anything goes wrong with the slides, yell at me, not at Alan. And I think we can go ahead and get started. So welcome to the January meeting of the Q&A for Ottawa PC User Group. And we'll start off with a follow-up. So we were talking, or there was some chat going on in the last meeting about license keys. And so there was a couple of comments posted into there. Jeff mentioned that there are programs, key finders, that will retrieve your keys. This happens to be important in particular when you move up to a new computer and you have to reinstall your software. So you need all the license keys. Tom mentioned that BellARC Advisor can discover many of the licenses. And you could save a printout that. And here's just looking at the BellARC Advisor, and it's free for personal use. It's not a charged item for commercial or government use. It is forbidden for commercial or government use. And when you go into it, you can go in, it'll examine your system, tell you what your operating system is, the model of your computer, all that sort of good stuff. And with the details like that. And then it will sniff out as much as it can on your system, various software license keys that you may be able to use to reinstall. And in this case here, I think this is on Alan's computer, it found the Microsoft 365 license key, as well as Office 15 PowerShell, which is interesting that there's a license key for that because it's free. And there was a license key on that computer for Windows 10 Home as well. So certainly if you are missing any license keys and you want to reinstall your software, or you're moving to a different computer and you want to get your license keys to transfer them over to your new computer, something like BellARC Advisor may actually help you out there. And then in addition, we had some stuff on the best practices with dealing with going to a new computer. Stefan had some information on where he kept source files of everything that he installed on his computer so he could install it onto a new computer. And then he had the activation keys all in a folder called software. And so he can go and find that when and if he needs it. And then there was an article that Alan and I co-wrote on setting up a new computer, and Alan had the advice of keeping a maintenance log, which keep all the information about how you set it up, accounts that were done, software that was installed, configurations of software, and one of the things that he had advised as well is making sure that your license keys are noted there as well. Again, so if you have to install them again, you have all that information in one place. And then there's a couple of other slides Alan had of the maintenance log on his computer. So it has all kinds of information in there, tasks that he did after installing Linux, and things like that. So highly advised. I'm pretty bad at that myself. I'm not really good at, I'm good at the initial maintenance log, but I don't tend to keep it up, and I'm sure that's going to come to bite me at some point.
I can just chip in there, Chris.
Yep.
That slide also has an image of my Linux desktop, so I know how to set up the various icons if I reinstall Linux.
Oh, that's a good
And
idea.
in particular, I use a micro USB plugin to my router as a kind of a mini network attached storage. I can never remember the commands I have to give. So I've got the commands in there for Linux, for Windows, and for Android, so I can access the disk from any of those operating systems.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, anything that you rarely use, but you are going to need it, it's a really good idea to document it in one place so that you can find the information.
Chris?
Yeah, a couple of things. Firstly, you mentioned that you keep the source, or that Alan keeps the source. If you're coding, then the source code means actually the human written instructions that you then compile. But I think what he means by source is the actual executable that you downloaded. And I always keep one or two past versions in case a current thing blows up.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea either. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that was Stefan that had that he did. I do that. I'm pretty good at that, making sure that when I install software, the original installation media, I keep it around so that I can reinstall it if necessary. Alan, did you have anything to say about this part of your maintenance log?
Yeah, this is just noting my regular disk image backups when I make them. I don't keep them all, so I highlight the ones that are kind of active.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then everything else is just notes of, you know, tweaks and programs being installed and things like that.
Yeah, the customizations to software are the things that I find when you move to a new computer. If you don't have a record of all of those customizations, that's what makes a computer not terribly comfortable for weeks or months as you go, well, this doesn't feel the way it felt before, but I don't know why. Okay, Alan, do you want to talk to this?
Yes, there was also some discussion of, you know, can I transfer my installed programs to and data, I guess, but basically the installed programs to a new machine. And it's really quite difficult. There are applications that you can essentially purchase. I don't think there are any free ones that will try and transfer the installed software. But if you want to learn about the pitfalls, this is a really good video on how tricky it can be to do that, but also what to do in terms of refreshing an operating system completely and transferring the actual data files that you, your personal data files that don't exist anywhere else.
Yeah, one of the things I found really interesting about this is Leo says that he absolutely never uses programs, will transfer installed programs. So he installs the operating system, he installs his program, and then he transfers his data. And he says that, as far as he's concerned, it's such a complex environment that he doesn't trust any program to get it right in terms of transferring an installed program. And other people have had good success with it, but Leo absolutely does not do that. And I did it once, and I don't do it since. Okay. Another one for Alan.
Actually, I think that was mine.
Oh, okay. Oh, this is leading into yours. Okay. So yeah. Do you want to show from your computer, or did you want to have – you can advance my slides if you want. You got slide controls.
Okay. So it says allow multiple presentations. So I guess I X that out.
No, if you wanted to control mine, there should be slide controls down at the bottom of – near the bottom of the window where you're seeing the slide deck.
If I hit replace current share, that'll be my.
Oh, computer. Yeah, you can then share yours. Yep.
Okay, I'll go that route.
Yep. Okay.
I'm presuming you see something now.
Yep. Yep.
Okay, so 2 weeks ago there was a presentation on how to revive an old computer. It was Gary Explains. Anyway, now, why isn't that advancing? There we go. It advanced?
Yep.
Okay, great. Okay, so he was talking about replacing the mechanical drive to a solid-state drive updating the RAM and upgrading the operating system. In terms of upgrading the RAM, he suggests, you know, removing the back cover, presumably laptop or side, taking out the RAM, taking a look at it, and seeing what kind of memory is in the computer. Presumably we've lost the manual and we no longer can just look it up in the manual. So there's a much easier way to check your RAM, and that's using the crucial.com system scanner tool. Now this is a tool I've used many, many, many times. You can find whatever RAM is compatible. Of course, Crucial sells memory, so that's why the tool is there. And there's two ways you can accomplish it. You can either run the their update program, or you can use the system scanner tool, which is a downloadable executable. That tends to be the one I always use, so I choose that one. It is safe. It's been around a long time. I have no qualms about using it whatsoever. So you download the tool. When you click on the download, of course, to start my scan, it's going to come up and give you a terms of use, which you sort of have to say accept. That slides. So surprisingly, that was taken with my cell phone because there was no way to capture that pop-up. So you accept it. It automatically starts the download. The Crucial scan.exe file goes to my downloads directory, and I simply run the program. Now, this happened to scan an old desktop, my workhorse desktop that I'm working on right now, hence no camera. Now it comes up. As you can see under the memory tab, there are four slots in this machine. On the right, you'll see it can take a maximum of 32 gigs of memory. I have 16 in it, and that's suited me fine. And the last two slots are open. So ostensibly, I could put two more 8 gig sticks in there. Now, at the bottom of the screen, the upgrade advice, this is a fairly old machine, so I know that Crucial does not have RAM compatible. But what is important here is the product number on this screen gives me the model number of the stick-in slot in the first slot. Both happen to be the same, so you can see the product number, KH. I can Google that to get a number. But if I were to go down to the upgrade advisor, I get what I call we don't feed the dinosaurs screen because this machine is so old, and it says, you know, we don't have compatible memory upgrades for your system. But as I said, I have the product number of the Kingston RAM, and when I Google it, I can find out the actual specs on that stick of RAM directly off the Kingston website, so I can match the RAM. By doing that, I don't have to take them back off of a laptop. I don't have to take the side. I don't have to yank sticks of RAM, and I can keep using the computer while I'm searching. Chris indicated that his browser wasn't calling up the page for when he ran the upgrade, the system scanner tool on his computer. So he used the upgrade selector option on his machine, and it gave him what the compatible RAM was, complete with the type, the speed, which he could easily take to any computer store and buy the RAM there, if you didn't want to purchase it directly from Crucial. Now, the tool will also give you storage options. In my case, I have a couple of four terabyte drives. So they're in a RAID configuration. But I have no intention of updating this to it's fast enough for what I need. But if you did want to use that as an option, it would tell you, give you compatible options for solid state drives as well. So that's it. That's the Crucial system scanner tool at crucial.com.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jeff. And I don't see, well, there's a little bit of information on SATA SSDs in the chat. And it asks, there's one question from Corrine. What information does Crucial keep? Do you know?
I have no idea if they keep anything based on your machine or your IP address. I have no idea.
I wouldn't be surprised if the license agreement, when you install it, talks about that. And Stu asked, do you prefer this to the program HW Info?
I've never used HW Info. I've used a number of hardware monitor tools over the years, but I just find it was easy to remember. Just go to crucial.com. I don't have to carry anything on a memory stick, or I don't have to have the actual program. I can just go to crucial.com and run the scanner, so I find it convenient.
Yeah, one thing I think about HW Info, it'll tell you how much RAM is installed, but I don't think it tells you, you know, how many slots you have and how many slots are populated, which is really important because, you know, you may have, you know, for example, only two slots, and there you got 2 8 gigs in there, but you might be able to toss them and put in 16 gig RAMs or something like that. But by knowing how many slots you have and the maximum memory before you even crack the box, you know whether you're going to be able to do the upgrade or not, or
yeah,
what it's going to take to do it.
I actually just used the Crucial tool quite recently on an older i5 that had eight in it in a mechanical hard drive. And it was, the machine was being tossed. It was a fairly reasonable machine with a touchscreen. I put a solid state drive in it and 20 gigs of RAM for more or less $100. And it's a fully functional machine with reasonable speed for most uses.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. I think that's everything that was in the chat about that, so I'm going to go ahead and take the share back. And so now I'm going to give a bit of a shout-out to Microsoft, and I don't often give them praises, but when it comes to accessibility, I certainly do. Microsoft has been a leader in accessibility features in their operating systems for many, many, many years, and they continue to improve it over the years. So this comes from a website Microsoft has on Windows 11 and the accessibility features. So for vision, they have Narrator, where it can read out what it sees on the screen. It has color filters for people that are colorblind and various forms of color blindness, as well as just low sight, where, you know, you can do things like high contrast and stuff like that. You can adjust the text size for people who need text to be bigger. You have the magnifier, which can enlarge parts of the screen. Control here. There we go. Hearing features. You can actually have live captions from audio, so it can listen to the audio and actually give you captions from it. You can do mono audio. I'm not sure exactly why you would need to do that, but it does have the capability. You can also have it flash the screen when there are audio notifications coming up on your computer, which is kind of neat. For mobility features, it has voice access, where you can actually speak to your computer to do things. Eye control, where you can actually just look at different parts of the screen to actually have it do things. Or voice typing, where you can just read to it and it'll type things out. And for neurodiversity and learning features, they have things like the immersive reader and focus sessions, where it tries to take away some of the noise that is on the screen that might be distracting and things like that. So there's quite a few features that they have. And I'm going to play just a couple of minute video here that comes from Microsoft on their accessibility features.
People with disabilities have different lived experience. We bring solutions to things that are beneficial, better for everyone. The important thing is that you include us, and in that collaboration, we can create something together, and that is true human creativity.
My role is developing features for screen reader narrator. You know, one of the pieces of feedback that we heard was that the voices were sounding very robotic.
This is where you can get
think about listening to a voice 8 hours a day.
Recently, we are investing heavily to make natural-sounding voices available in Narrator.
Narrator is a screen reader that describes aloud what's on the
screen. My favorite voice is the Aria voice. Others really like the Jenny voice.
To start or stop Narrator, press the Windows logo key.
The response, fantastic. Keep providing that level of feedback. It's a joy to be a part of that process.
One of the bigger questions that the design team asked itself was, you know, how can we do better? Voice access allows the user to control Windows 11 completely hands-free. Show numbers here. 4. My personal favorite part of voice access is how beautiful assistive technologies tend to never get the same polish that perhaps mainstream experiences do. We really wanted to put our foot down and change that for the better.
As designers, it's really important to try to solve for real problems and real people. It always went back to Leah.
At the beginning of the pandemic, the things I didn't notice before became very clear to me, and specifically the lack of captions. So I ended up using my laptop, plus I had my phone, and that's how I solutioned to give myself full access.
Here is a huge opportunity for Windows as we think about the next set of features and something that can be useful for a broader audience.
Live captions, it's a really small piece of UI that you can move anywhere. It was us to reflect back on how we can design better for everyone.
It's really exciting.
I joined conversations, I provided, and now I use it in some situations, and it is a game changer.
You know, there's no I in team, and
in order to create something to solve for one, we're also extending to many.
So I really do have to hand it to Microsoft on accessibility features. They've done a lot of work on it, and they continue to work on it a lot. So, and these are useful for people that don't have disabilities as well. So take a look if you see any features on there that you might be able to take advantage of.
Chris, if I could just add a quick note about
the
narrator and their speech access. As you know, I have quite a bit of familiarity with screen reader programs for the vision impaired. Although Narrator does provide the new Windows SAPI programs have great access to natural speech. As a standalone screen reader, they're not as featured as one might like. If you have a visual disability, you probably would want to take a closer look at Freedom Scientific's JAWS program, which is Job Access with Speech. It's pretty expensive, but it's worth the kick. But if you're just looking for an open source program that is fairly good and will work with the Microsoft Natural Voices, take a look at NVDA, Non-Visual Desktop Access, a nonprofit. They come out of Australia. It's free to use. They're based on donations. And it's pretty robust. You can also throw it on a USB stick and take it anywhere. So those would be the two I would recommend.
Okay, great. Thanks. And we have some comments in the chat with a couple of links to things like JAWS and so forth. So check those out. Okay, onwards. So I have a share here on disk cleanup. Now, part of this was it came out of the fact that most of the stuff that I'm going to be presenting tonight and next week is stuff that we've already seen in bits and pieces here and there, Q&A, and general meetings. I thought it was worthwhile to sort of pull together all of the stuff that I've seen before on disk cleanup in one place. So we're going to talk about disk cleanup in a very general sense and why you want to deal with it. So Windows needs, you know, a lot of breathing room for storage. On the Windows partition, which is usually your C drive, Microsoft actually says you need at least 20 gigabytes of space for 64-bit versions, 16 gigs of free space after the user has completed the out-of-box experience and automatic maintenance cleanup part of it. And there's a link there on you can read a little bit more about it. That's a lot of space that's required. The annual feature updates can take over 20 gigabytes. And so those are like going from, you know, Windows 11 23H2 to 24H2 or whatever. So a lot of space is required whenever you get those feature updates. Microsoft recommends keeping at least 20 gigabytes free space on the system drive. And many people I've seen recommend keeping at least 20% free space. Now, I think that might be a bit of a stretch on today's storage where you have, you know, maybe 2 terabytes of space. Do you really need to keep 400 gigabytes free space? Probably not. So as you get larger and larger storage, I think that idea of 20% free space is probably not the case anymore. So other reasons for cleanup. Well, you know, we all do have a very comprehensive backup strategy, right? So we keep multiple copies of things. You might have duplicate data files or program files or who knows what that you have multiple copies of on your computer. When you back up, it's taking time to do it. The more you have duplicate information or extra information on your computer, the longer backups are going to take, and the more space is going to be taken up on the backup drive for those backup files. Another reason might be security and privacy. So if you have programs, virtually guaranteed that, almost an axiom that programs have security vulnerabilities. Question is, who's going to find them? Is it going to be the vendor who's going to fix the problem, or is it going to be the bad guys who are going to exploit the problem before they get fixes out to everybody who's running the program? So if you consider that every program can and probably does have security vulnerabilities, if you're not using them, why not get rid of them? And that way you don't have a security vulnerability sitting there that may be exploited at some point in the future. As well, cleaning up things such as web caches could remove sensitive data that might be stored on your hard drive. It's a little bit of a mug's game on that, in that if you clear your web cache, in a couple of days it seems to be back to half a gigabyte or more as well. But cleaning that up can help. And then performance issues. So if you have a cluttered storage, especially if you're on a hard disk drive rather than a solid-state drive, it can lead to file fragmentation. Files that get fragmented on your hard drive take longer to read and write. And so that can hit your performance big time if you have a very cluttered storage drive. So the first thing to ask yourself is, do you actually have a problem or not? So I go into File Explorer, and I look under This PC and Windows C drive, and I can see on here I don't actually have a problem. I'm only using 632 gigabytes, so 66% of the – 632 gigabytes free space. So I don't have a problem. But still, I like to – you know, keep things trim and secure and as much as possible. So I think even though you might not vision it here as being a problem, you may want to look into it anyways. So this week we're going to look at two cleanup methods, StorageSense and storage, and disk cleanup, which are all built into Windows. So to get into storage, you go into Settings, System, and then Storage. And it'll bring up a very abbreviated list. And I think on Windows 11, this is basically all it comes up with. It'll have installed apps, other, and temporary files. But then there's a Show More Categories link that you can click on. I suggest you immediately click on that because then you'll end up with a much longer list of different areas where people typically end up with files being stored. And it is sorted by size. So the categories at the top are the ones you really want to concentrate on. So you can see here you have installed apps, and that, if you click on that, it'll just jump you to the settings apps. So you can go in and you can uninstall any apps or whatever you need to do there. So it doesn't do anything special on its own. The next one is system and reserved, and I would say avoid that altogether because you don't want to be going in messing around with things that the operating system needs to run properly. So I think that they should actually just leave that off the list or actually don't allow you to click on it. Then you end up with a whole bunch of other categories, and so there's other, which, I don't know what that entails, right? Temporary files, desktop. Other people is an interesting one because other people will be local accounts on your computer that are using up space. So say you create an account for a friend who comes over or a relative who's visiting for a month, and you create an account for them on the computer. They do all kinds of stuff, downloading things and creating files and so forth, and then they go back home, and then this account is just sitting there using up space. So if you go into other people, you could actually see the different accounts identified and how much space could be cleaned up. And then there's all kinds of other categories on there. And you can see on this particular computer, I don't have an awful lot that are in those categories. But the biggest one is other. So I click on it, and then it brings up a whole bunch of different locations where I have a lot of files. And again, sorted by size. And I can see at the top is My Drive, which is Google Drive folder, and I'm using up about 5 gigs on there. Now, if I click on that, then it will open up File Explorer at that location, and I can do whatever cleanup that I want to do. So if I decided, well, I really don't want to give up 6 gigabytes or 5 gigabytes of space for my Google Drive, I could go in and I could look at it and say, oh yeah, there's these folders I have in there. I really don't need them to be available on Google Drive, and get rid of them. So you can do that for each of the categories. And again, because it's sorted by size, start at the top, and then once you get down to, you know, whatever size you care about, you know, you can just stop looking at things below that. You're not going to have big bang for the buck. You can see down at the bottom of Patch My PC is using up 4 kilobytes. I'm not going to waste my time cleaning that up. Then we get into Storage Sense. So this allows you to have automated cleanup of the Recycle Bin and your Downloads folder if you want. So to get to that, you go to System, Settings, System, Storage, and then Storage Sense. You click on that. You can see it's turned off here. You just click on that, and it'll bring up the configuration options for it. You can toggle it on. Until you toggle it on, you can't configure it. So you actually have to toggle it on to configure it. And then you say when you want Storage Sense to run. And the default is during low free disk space. Now, I tried to find out what Microsoft means by low disk free disk space, and there's no one answer, so I think it depends on a number of factors. But you can have it run just by itself whenever it determines that it's getting low on space. Or you can set it to run every day, every week, or every month. Then what do you actually want to have happen? So you can have it delete files in the Recycle Bin if they've been there for over a certain period of time, anything from never through 1 day, 14 days, up to 60 days. And the way I think it makes sense to look at that is that if you delete something and it goes into the Recycle Bin, what is the likelihood that you are going to need it if you left it sitting there for 30 days, for example? And if you say, now, if it's been in the Recycle Bin for 30 days and I haven't missed it up until now, I don't care. Then set it to 30 days. And then there's the files in the Downloads folder. And if they haven't been opened in more than, and it's getting the same periods of time, I leave that to never, the default, because for me, I use my Downloads folder as a storage spot that if I download something, I just leave it there until such time as I specifically decide to go and clean up that folder and say, oh, yeah, I don't need that, whatever. But I'll leave things in there for years. So I just leave that to never. But you can set each of those parameters to what makes sense for you. In addition, there's a tool called Disk Cleanup, and this is an older tool. I think it's been around since at least Windows 7, maybe even older, but it's still extremely useful. It has some very broad categories for cleanup. In Windows 11, you go Start All Windows Tools Disk Cleanup, or you can just hit Start and start typing in Disk Cleanup. It'll come up in the results. Or on Windows 10, it's under Start Windows Administrative Tools Disk Cleanup. Or again, if you just click on the Start button and just start typing Disk Cleanup, it'll pop up in the list. Okay, so I did talk before about using Disk Cleanup in one of our Q&As, so the link is there if you want to read those slides. But I'll basically go through it here. So when you run it, it comes up and it says select the drive you want to clean up, and it will be by default your Windows drive, normally drive C. You click on OK, and then it'll come up and it'll tell you how much it can clean up. And you can see in here that it can't clean up all that much on my system. Only 118 megabytes. So you might think, well, this is a pretty useless tool if all it can do is that. But if you look down here, you'll see a button called Clean Up System Files. Immediately, don't even look at anything above it, just immediately click on that. The program will close and it'll reload, and then it'll come up with a different number. So in this case here, just by clicking that button, it reloaded, and it went from being able to clean up 118 megabytes to 1.44 gigabytes. So 12 times the amount of space that it could be cleaning up. Why? Because, for example, on this one here, it offered to clean up Windows upgrade log files, which on my system right at the time this ran, there were 1.08 gigabytes of Windows upgrade log files. They didn't put that in when it first came up because the list in the first instance is more stuff that most people are just going to, it's not going to matter if you delete it. You look at the list, temporary internet files, things like that. It's usually pretty safe stuff. When you get into the cleanup system files, it's a little bit more likely that you'll run into something that maybe you don't want to clean up. Now, how do you determine whether you want to clean that up or not? Well, you click on any one of the lines, and it'll show you a description, and it tells you here it's the Windows upgrade log files, and they have information that can help troubleshoot problems when you do a Windows installation or an upgrade or servicing. And if you delete them, it could be difficult to troubleshoot installation issues. Well, if I've installed something like Windows updates or things like that, and I've been using the computer for several days and I've had no problem, then it's highly unlikely that I'm actually going to have to troubleshoot a problem with the installation of whatever I just did. So by and large, when I see Windows upgrade log files, I'll just delete them because to me, they're just wasting space on my system. But you can go through all of those descriptions and decide whether it's something that's important to you or not. So that's this week. So we covered off storage and storage sense and disk cleanup. And then next week, I'm going to cover off all of the other things that you see on the items. So how to uninstall unused programs, how to move large files to other drives or partitions off of your C drive, which is the one you have to be most critically aware of free space on, how to disable hibernation if you're not using it, using a couple of other programs to analyze your data storage, using CCleaner as a nice app for doing disk cleanup or doing various disk cleanup type tasks, and then talking about upgrading your storage. So we'll cover off those next week. And if anybody else has any other ideas for cleaning up on storage, by all means, send in an email to suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we will include whatever we can put together. And I see there's a couple of comments. Tom says you can also empty the recycle bin. That's one of the things Disk Cleanup definitely will offer to do. For a hard drive, my defrag does a better job. So there are a number of defragging programs around there that beyond what is built into Windows for sure. What program? Oh, you did DM to me. Okay, I'll get back to Tom on that. And then Bob Harris just wanting to review the slides. So good. Okay, so next week we will carry on with more information on how to do the cleanup, and that'll probably wrap it up for that topic. Okay. Now I would like to turn it over to Jocelyn, and he is going to talk to us about GNUcache, or GNUcache.
GNUcache, yes. Screen. Okay, so I hope everybody can see my screen now.
In a second. Yep, there it is.
All right. So what I want to talk is a program called GNUcache, which is an accounting software. So let's see if I can control it. Yes. So it's a program that is freely available to anybody for free. It's available for Linux, Windows, and Apple. It's supported actively, and it's relatively easy to use, but it's based on professional accounting principle. So it can be used for home or business, no problem. You can download it from that GNUcache website. It comes with a manual. There is one that is pretty well done and quite total, or if you want just to start, there's also a Git started manual. So that's something that I found very instructive, because I'm not an accountant, I have no training in that, but I found it quite useful to get started and learn some basic principle.
Joss, we have a request from Eldon in the chat, if you can speak a little louder. Or Eldon, if you can turn up your speakers, because it's not a whole lot different than what we've had from other speakers. But
okay, can you hear me well now?
Eldon, is that better?
Is that better?
Yes, thank you. That's much better.
Okay, thank you. There is that different ways. You can use just a spreadsheet to keep your accounting, and that's something I've done a long time. But I find that when things get a bit more complicated, it's quite easy to make mistakes and to forget things and get to modify things and not realizing that it is set up something else in the wrong way. So I find that using a real accounting software is a good way, recommended to do real accounting. You will very quickly find out it helps you a lot to make sure that you have all the data correctly. It uses what they call a double entry. So basically it means that everything has a source and a destination. So if you go to the ATM machine, you withdraw, let's say, $20 from the ATM. That $20 has to go somewhere. It goes to the wallet. So, for example, and that's something that when you use GNUcache, you always have to always enter two things: where is the source and where is the destination. And I find that it's all in a lot of areas also useful. For example, if you have a draw and you know. It's always good to have two ways to count everything. If you sell 10 tickets that are $10 each, you should count how many tickets you have sold, and it should match the total of the sale, which is 100. So if you have the two ways of checking for everything, you can be pretty sure that your data is accurate. So that's the idea behind that double entry. So when you start, I have my presentation in two parts. So I'm just going to go through a very simple example. When you start on one of the main tab is what they call the account name. That has all the accounts that you have in your books. So, for example, on when you start it, you have to set up all the accounts properly, and you have to put them in the right place because it won't work otherwise. For example, in order to create a new account, you click on the account. Under the condo barbecue, for example, you can edit the thing, and then you enter the account name, the description, the parent account kind of stuff. So that's the first thing that you will have to do when you start to create the thing. I will get into that a little bit later. So when you start a program, it will offer you a number of default hierarchy for all the accounts. It can be, for example, a simple checkbooks or business or car loan, whatever. Myself, I find it's easier to start from scratch, but that can be also another option. So there are five different type of accounts that are used there. One is the asset. That's basically, for example, your bank accounts, your wallet, your GICs, or anything that you own. The other two is the expense and income. I think those are pretty easy to understand. So all the incomes is the thing that you get from your paychecks, or if somebody pays for a product, or and for the expenses when you go to the grocery or any expense, a car, anything. Another one is, the fourth one is the liability. This is all the things that you owe. For example, your credit card, or if you borrow some money from somebody, that's where you would put all the liability. And the last one, this one is not that often used. This one is used, for example, when you start, for example, often your bank account start with a certain amount in it. So that's where you would put the opening balance into it. Same thing, if you close the account, you would move the thing from the bank account to the equity account. So that's basically used to open and close the year, or finish the year kind of thing. So I'm going to do an example. For the Canada Day in my condo, we did a little barbecue. So I used the new cash to create, to track down all the purchases and the incomes and all the things. So along the presentation, I'm going to ask a couple of questions, and I challenge you to try to answer in your mind what you would do in that particular case. Okay. So the first thing we needed to do is, in order to do barbecue, is we needed to buy the stuff, the drink, the cutlery, and all that stuff. So as per the double entry principle, we always need two accounts. So my question is, what are the two accounts we need to set up in order to buy the stuff before the barbecue? So I'll let you think a few seconds to think what you would do for that, what account you would use. Could be an expense, could be an asset, could be a liability. I think this one is not too hard. So obviously, since we're going to buy stuff, we'll have to make expenses. So what I did is I click on the new, and then on the new account, I said, okay, I give a name, for example, the groceries. And then I tell what is the parent account. It will be under expenses. And I enter what type of account it is. In this case, an expense. Because the way that NewCash works is that all the numbers are going to be positive. So whether it's an income or an expense, everything is positive. So that's what the account type will do, is the math will differ depending on what type you are using. So the second part, the double entry, is somebody has to pay for that purchases. And we, for the second part of the double entry part, is going to be a liability. So for example, again, I click under the account, I click a new, and I enter the account name. That person was Trudy. I enter a description, Trudy purchases, and the account type is liability. One thing that you have to keep in mind is the thing is looking from the barbecue events. You're not looking from Trudy perspective or the bank perspective, all that stuff. Is that when you are creating the new cash, it's always from the whole thing as a perspective. And as you can see, under liability, I have the four person that did make all the purchases. And under expense, under groceries, I have the total of all the groceries. So once the account is set up, now comes the time to enter the transaction itself. So I open the account Trudy. I enter the date. I enter a description. And then I select the account. In this case, grocery. And I enter the amount. And I select the second account, which is Trudy, and enter the same amount. And the two has to match, or the total of the two has to match. So I simply enter all the transactions. So in this case, I have hot dogs, I had different napkins and all that stuff. So you enter, once the accounts are set up, you just enter as they come in. There are two ways to look at all the data. There is from the grocery perspective or from the Trudy perspective. And the same transaction appears in two different places. You see here from the grocery perspective, you have the amount here. And here you have the from the Trudy perspective, the amount. So it will show you all the totals for each of the different type of account. So next thing. In order to, for the barbecue, we needed to have some change for the event. So my question is, what are the two accounts that we need to set up for the pay to cash? So again, I'll let you think a little bit about the two that you would choose for that. So, the pay to cash was one of the volunteers provided the advances the money. So this is going to be a liability because that person did loan the starting money. So again, I enter the two entries, one pay to cash and one under the person who borrowed the thing. So those are the two. Finally, we have the barbecue. So I created a new account under the income, and we generated a number of sales. So we got for the event, we had $176, and that goes into the account. All right. After the barbecue, came the time to refund people that had borrowed. Fortunately, we had more income than we had sales, so that turned out pretty good. So, So, okay. So that was relatively simple. So we refunded all the amount that people provided. But I had one little twist. There are two different twists to the thing. Is that, as we all know, the pennies no longer exist. So we had to round the thing plus minus 5 cents. So the question came is what to do with that thing in order to account the thing properly. And again, I offer you three choices. One is to do nothing. The leftover was relatively small, so we don't care. The other option is to move the money to the barbecue asset. And the third one was to simply say, okay, just make the final amount to zero. So let's explore all three options. One option is simply to do nothing, which is not a bad option because we're dealing with small amount, but it's not proper accounting. I wanted to make sure that every single cent was accounted for. And in this case, it's a small amount for a barbecue, but if you have a business and you have big amounts, it can matter. It can make a difference. So at the end of the exercise, I want to make sure that all the accounts can go to zero in order to close the books properly. So the second option was to move, that was the first thing I did, is to move all the money back to the barbecue asset account. But that gave me a surprise because, for example, there was 27 cents left. And so I said, okay, no problem. So move the 25 cents that Dorothy gave us and put it back into the barbecue account. Sounds good enough. But when you do that, you will see that the barbecue account, instead of going up, since there was a donation, it went down, which was a bit of a surprise. And one thing I did find out with NuCash, if things don't work the way they are supposed to, is because probably you have not set up the account properly. So what I had to do, the third option was to use the third account to the equity account to do the proper things. Because when somebody gives you money, they say, I don't want the change. When you think about it, you're not losing money, you're not gaining money. You just, what you have in your hands does not change. So the income and the assets, none of that change. So what I had to do is I transferred the leftover 27 cents left to the equity account. And that did clear all the accounts. And at the end, as you can see, everything goes to zero. So the last step was to close the barbecue account because I didn't want to keep the money myself. And we wanted to sort of transfer the whole thing to the condo because I don't own the money. It's the condo. So I created a new account that I called basically the condo in trust. So the condo will keep the money for future events. So, and the last step was to write a report to give a copy to everybody to make sure that everything was done properly. And NuCash has acquired a large amount of reports that you can create. So you can have all the transaction, or you can have the profit and loss, or all the general ledger. So there is a large number of accounts. I will talk about that a little bit more next time. So basically, this is the end results of the thing. So as you can see, the condo barbecue, we had an income of 176, and all the refunds were done, and the amount was deposited. So at the end of the exercise, the total for the condo barbecue was zero. That's what I want. The condo in trust has 45 left in storage for future events. The equity will have some time positive if someday, if one, depending on the way the change works out. So some are positive, some are negative, but there, it's not, this is what's the sort of one takes all the things, it left 6 cents. Here you have the total for all the groceries. So it costs us $131 to buy all the stuff. This is the income. And one of the person that was providing the funds paid $20.27. We refunded $20, and we closed. There was 27 donation. So, and we closed and put that in the equity. And so that particular account goes back to zero. So all the people that provided money, that account goes to zero, and so that's the one way to keep track of every single cent from the start to the end. So if you have any questions.
I only see one question in the chat. Corrine asks, where are the receipts kept?
I keep the receipts into an envelope, the paper receipts, I keep them so I can provide all the evidence at the last meeting we had at the end. And I provided those receipts to, at the same time as I gave back the money for storage for future events.
And Stu, ever the joker, says, Joss, what about the leftover food?
Fortunately, there was not too many left, and we distributed the money. So we distributed the leftover money.
Okay, that's all I see there. If there are any other questions, we have some comments about it being interesting and so forth. Other than that, I think it's pretty much cleared on that. So thanks very much, Joss. And as I understand it, you're going to have a follow-up presentation as well?
Yes, we'll get more into using for business issues. This was a simple example, but it can get more complicated when you get into a business.
Okay, that's great. Thanks very kindly. And let me just take over the share. We are just over time now, but I'll just wrap it up with the standard stuff that we have for the end. So just a reminder of our one-on-one remote assistance program. It's been a success so far. We've actually had 6 items go through the queues. And so if you're interested in anything that you think is a little bit trickier than can be handled at a Q&A session, for example, by all means, you can email in to oneononerequest@opcug.ca, and we'll look into helping you out with that. Reminder, special offer, any new people with us tonight, if you pay your membership by March 31st, you'll actually get 2 years for the price of one. So deal on there till March 31st. And if you go to opcug.ca/join or renew, or if you just go to the homepage and click the join or renew button, that'll take you to the right spot. And if you are already a member in good standing, please do not send us your money. You do not need to renew your membership. Your membership expiry date will be automatically extended a further year from its current value as of March 31st. We'll be doing that. So no need to send us any more money. A reminder of some of the upcoming presentations of the Ottawa Public Library. All of them, all 33 of them that are coming up are listed on our website, and 30 of them so far are available for registration at the Ottawa Public Library website. So we have these 3 are the coming up. Armchair Travel at Iceland at Ruth E. Dickinson on the 21st. I'm giving Quick PC Tips at Centennial on the 23rd, and Keeping Passwords Safe at Rockville Park on January 30th. And the February meeting, I'm going to be giving on how to buy a PC. We thought this might be appropriate given the end of life coming up for Windows 10 next fall, that some people may be looking at the solution being buying a new PC as opposed to going without updates or trying to upgrade their current computer so that it can take Windows 11. So that'll be on February 12th. So hope to see you all out at that. And our next Q&A is going to be January 22nd, next Wednesday evening. Send in any questions, answers, or topics that you wish to share to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And in particular, more disk cleanup issues. If anybody has other ways of doing disk cleanup that they think are appropriate, send them in and we'll include them in the presentation that I give on that topic. And with that, I would like to thank everybody for showing up tonight and hope to see you next week.